This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Race Your Game. I'm Frida Liu. Be ambitious. Find everlasting love. Look after your health. There are countless stories about how we ought to live our lives. Now, these narratives can make our lives easier and they might sometimes make us happier too, but they can also trap us and those around us. In Happy After, Ever After, bestselling happiness expert Professor Paul Dolan draws on a variety of studies ranging over well-being, inequality, discrimination and life satisfaction across the globe to bust the common myths about our sources of happiness. Now, Paul Dolan is Professor Behavioral Science at the LSE. Pleasure speaking to you, Professor.
Hello, good morning. Pleasure speaking to you too. And please call me Paul.
Okay. So we've got your book, Happy Ever After, Escaping the Myth of the Perfect Life. Why, of course, this is your second book after Happiness by Design, which was the first one. Why do you think it was important to write this book? And I know you started the book talking about a panel discussion you were on.
Yes, I was at a festival and I was walking across the fields after being on a panel discussion and I had a man about my age, maybe a little bit older, come up to me and he sort of said that he quite liked my first book. But then he said, but why do you have to play the working class hero? And I was kind of a bit puzzled by that. And he said, and he was really quite funny because he pointed me up and down and said, look at you doing it now. And I was, I'm not quite sure what I was doing exactly. But he then proceeded to berate me for not being as he would expect a professor at the LSE to be, to look like, to sound like, and to act like. And that kind of, well, I mean, I've been alert to that to some degree before, but it kind of crystallized the thoughts in my mind that I was having about how, you know, we're sort of expected to behave in particular ways given our conditions and our jobs in particular. And I just sort of wanted to see the degree to which whether, you know, those sort of expectations that are placed upon us.
Right.
Actually would make us happy if we lived our lives according to them. Mm. And it sort of follows up from Happiness by Design in the sense that in there I set out a case for why people should seek to maximize pleasure and purpose over time, mm-hmm. accounting for the impact that their own actions and happiness have on other people. And I realized that that's actually really quite difficult because of some of these stories and narratives around how we ought to be living our lives. And I sort of wanted to sort of discuss in a bit more detail some of those barriers and obstacles to people leading lives that would otherwise make them happier.
Right. You know, I was reading your book and it did get me thinking a lot. So your book was divided into three sections, and reaching, related and responsible. What does each denote?
Yes. So I like alliterations for the start. So once I had two of them starting with R, then the third one had to. Mm. The reaching narratives, I guess, will be the ones that people are probably most familiar with, I suppose. That's kind of why they start the book as well. There's sort of a sort of gentle easing maybe with the less contentious issues to the more contentious ones. But reaching narratives are essentially the sense that we should be reaching for ever more irrespective of how much we have. So I talk about there's three chapters in each of the three parts, and then reaching its wealth, success and education. And we're kind of expected to be striving for more of those things, to be ever wealthier, ever more successful and ever more clever, irrespective of where we are. And it's certainly true that, you know, poverty and lack of status and so on make people miserable. And you can get big returns to happiness from small increases in income when you're poor. But once you get to sort of, you know, basic levels of income, really, not much more than that, you know, your kind of happiness starts to level off. And in some of the data that I discuss in the book, actually it appears, and of course it is correlational, not causal, but it appears that the happiness actually even starts to fall as people become ever wealthier. So it's like an addiction, essentially. You just need to keep consuming and buying and accumulating more and more and more, and the happiness data suggests that that's actually often past the point at which it's optimal.
Yes, it's diminishing returns.
Diminishing returns. And actually even falling returns, decreasing returns. And I think what happens, especially what happens with money, is that you know, when you're poor, of course, you're paying attention to the fact you can't feed the kids, pay the bills, whatever. That's very attention-seeking. And you sort of get to income levels where you're okay, and you're not thinking about money very much. But as you get ever wealthier, then you start worrying about money in a different way. You know, do I have the right investments? Have I got the right stocks? And it starts drawing attention to itself in other ways that are not always helpful.
Right. You talk about the SDO, the social dominance orientation. What does that mean?
Yeah, interesting. So there's the reason I don't really go into too much about where these narratives come from. Mm-hmm. So whether they be historical accident, evolutionary advantage, social construction, but they get reinforced and magnified by the extent when people feel that they need hierarchies and structures and organisations in society. So people that are high on SDO, social dominance orientation, are people that have a strong belief in structure and hierarchy and the fact that kind of society is well ordered. Mm. And so for them, people that might want to live lives outside of the norm, is going to be quite challenging, and that's part of the reason why they often judge. There's actually a number of reasons why we might judge people harshly, but that's part of the reason why we judge people harshly who live outside of that, because because it calls into question the way that we think society should be organized.
Mm. You know, when I was reading the book, I went straight to marriage and monogamy. what are some gems from these areas?
I know. I would imagine that most people go to chapter 5 on monogamy first in the book. It's written in an order, but I'm not sure they read it in that order. Let's deal with marriage first. Well, the message of the book is actually really, it shouldn't be controversial to anybody, is that, you know, marriage, like any of these other narratives, it's going to be great for some people, maybe some of the time, but not all of the people all of the time. And we just need to relax a little bit about the judgments we make of people that might live alternatively, and particularly single people. Right. I mean, the way that we treat single people is quite shocking, really. You'd never get away with that if you treated people of different races or genders, right, or whatever, in the way that we treat single people. We kind of look at them as, they're not sort of grown up yet, right? Mm. I mean, they sort of, you know, you're not a fully fledged adult until you've ticked off the marriage. And single people get discriminated against at work. They always get the last dibs on holidays. They kind of expected to work longer hours, cover for their married counterparts. And they're seen as, it's really interesting, it's almost seen as selfish and yet when, if we look at some of the evidence, you know, the people that are more likely to start up charities, engage in pro-social behaviours, they're much more likely to be single people than the selfish married people that haven't got time for anyone else because they're paying too much attention to their partner. When we look at some of the happiness data, it's really interesting. I mean, it's just sort of like to summarise evidence rather bluntly and crudely, and you'd expect academics to want to add caveats to all of this, but in the bluntest and crudest possible way, there is a little bit of a gender difference in the sense that men, you know, sort of broadly benefit from being married. They sort of calm down a little bit. They take fewer risks. They earn a bit more money and live a bit longer. Whereas she has to put up with all of that, women that never married live longer than those that get married. So aside from financial reasons in more patriarchal societies, it's kind of a question as to actually why women would bother getting married. Monogamy, do you want me to talk about that?
Right. Yes, please. Sort that out.
Okay. Well, so, interestingly, I talk about in the book, and people have to sort of look at their hands to do this, there's a measure of in vitro testosterone, so how much testosterone you were exposed to in the womb, is reflected in the ratio of your second finger to your fourth finger.
Okay.
And the longer that ratio, so the more your index finger, your ring finger is compared to your pointy finger, then the more testosterone you were exposed to. And this it actually correlates very highly with a whole range of people's behaviours, particularly in relation to risk taking. And so people with higher testosterone take more risk, and that also transfers across into sexual behaviours and attitudes towards sex. So number of sexual partners, whether you think it's acceptable to have sex outside marriage, all those kinds of things. And what the latest evolutionary theory suggests is that actually men and women sort into two groups. It's not a normal distribution, it's bimodal. So you've basically got men that sort into, essentially, and this is again putting it very bluntly and crudely, you've got men that sort into cads on the one hand and dads on the other hand. So ones with higher levels of testosterone, taking more risks, having more partners, cheating on partners, and dads who are the opposite.
Right.
The proportions are sort of roughly like 57-43 or something in favour of cats. But what's really interesting is in women, where the split between, I call them mothers and lovers, is probably not ideal language, but, you know, women that are more predisposed to being sexually active and seeking sexual variety, they actually represent almost half, about 47% of the population, with 53% being mothers. And that's a much higher rate of women who may desire sexual variety than I think we would expect, and certainly the men would want to allow. It makes good sense for men to want to constrain the sexual behaviours of their partners and wives, because if they're going to invest in offspring, they'd ideally like to know that those offspring are theirs. But from the woman's perspective, and actually now this is what's really interesting from an evolutionary perspective, is the suggestion that genetic diversity is evolutionarily advantageous. So essentially, that, you know, some women will have the first child with a dad and then go off and have a second child with a cad. As long as that cad doesn't look too much different to the dad will bring up the kid as if it's his. So there's some sort of interesting suggestions around how what might be optimal for the evolution of our species might not be optimal in relation to the narratives that we construct around it, and in particular how men seek to constrain, often with good reason, the sexual behaviours of women. But the fundamental point, though, is that there actually isn't really that much difference between the desire for sexual variety amongst men and women. And if anything, you know, when husbands say, "My wife has gone off sex," what he really should finish that sentence with is, "My wife has gone off sex with me." Because he's often, again, this is, you know, kind of going, sort of trying to kind of, you know, sort of summarize some very, you know, kind of complex evidence in a blunt sentence. But you know, he's sort of by and large happy to just keep having sex with the same person forever, to some degree. But she needs a bit more of a different experience. So that's what I talk about in that chapter. I feel like I was sort of digging myself into a deeper and deeper hole with this now. But that's what the evidence tells us. What can I say?
Right. We'll talk a little bit about money, wealthy, one of your chapters in just a moment. I'm here with Paul Dolan talking about his book, Happy Ever After, Escaping the Myth of the Perfect Life. BFM 89.9.
Because friends matter. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
You're listening to Race Again on Enterprise. Good morning. This is Fria Liu. If you've just joined us, I'm here with Paul Dolan, a professor of behavioral science at the LSE. We're talking about his second book, a first book being Happiness by Design. And this is Happy Ever After, Escaping the Myth of the Perfect Life. Now, you think like your thoughts transcends people of all different races and religion. You know, say someone in Asia, do you think these thoughts apply throughout?
Yeah, that's a super question. So first of all, I should say that I am, by and large, from an academic perspective, quite ignorant of cultural variations. I mean, I've spent all of my academic life really working in the UK, policy making in the UK, and to some degree North America, but nowhere else. And I don't claim to be an expert on cultural differences and cultural variation. So that's the first and most important thing I can say. I do try, though, with these narratives to pick, you know, why these ones. Well, they kind of seem to be ones that have stood the test of time across a lot of cultures,
right?
And also there may be good reason why psychologically we are wired is too strong a term, but, you know, sort of predisposed to some degree to seek them out and to live according to them. So, you know, narratives around status, for example, whilst what is recognized as being high status and low status may have some cultural variation, the fact that we value people of higher status more than those of lower status, and there's all sorts of advantages around returns to income and attractiveness and mating from being seen of as high status, is going to be pretty universal.
Right. What about education? How does education affect our happiness?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, this is one of those I was probably like, you know, some of these things surprise you in looking at the data. The associations, and again, you know, I'd love to do some randomized controlled trials where I allocate people to different education levels, but that's not possible. But the correlations between, you know, education and happiness are very weak. Hmm. You know, it's kind of, again, as with some of the other narratives, good to have little bits of it, but probably not too much. So, you know, you kind of need basic levels of education and maybe a little bit more beyond that. But the sort of ever-reaching quest for more and more is probably not good for individuals, and interestingly, maybe not good for society. So there's certainly some evidence suggesting that, you know, you get economic growth from education, but whether that growth could have been created by using the resources that went into higher education differently is an open question. And of course, there are also downsides to some of what we see through growth in terms of the environmental impact and so on. Right. So we certainly ought to be investing more resources into research and development and innovation. Whether that all needs to be done through higher education institutions is an open question. And I'm pretty convinced that we should be redirecting some of the resources that we put into higher education into further education, into vocational training in particular. Hmm. And to sort of, you know, because in the UK it's become this sort of narrative that it's university or bust. Hmm. And I think that's, I don't think that's true. And it right. also creates a story that can be quite harmful for the currently 50% of people in the UK that don't go to university.
Right, which sort of leads to the what you talk about, the class ceiling. And these are the nuances, I guess, that you get in the UK from the way you sound, from the way you look, right? I mean, from the way I sound and where you're from, right? So is this something more apparent in the UK, though?
Interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, you know, I like to keep most of what I say to the evidence that's in front of me rather than making stuff up. I mean, I don't, the class system, you know, class is something that is in the way that it manifests itself, probably uniquely British, yeah. But the fact that society organizes itself into social strata, and when you achieve a higher social standing, however that's defined and measured, I'm sure wherever you live, whatever country you're from, you are expected to fit in with the norms of that particular group in the social strata. Right. I think I don't believe that, you know, the way the class, as I said, where the class manifests itself might be different in the UK, but the idea that when you become, you know, rich and successful and clever or whatever, that you ought to engage in particular activities, for example, or not engage in certain others, I think is going to be universal. There's an expectation that you behave in a particular way, right, consistent with your place in the social hierarchy.
Right. So under wealthy, you said the journey to riches for most people will be lonely, unpleasant, and fruitless. So it makes more sense to take the shorter path to just enough. Now, how do people take that sort of, you know?
Oh, that's quite a nice line. Is that play my words?
Yes.
I quite like those. Well, it's a kind of cliche. It's a really cliche thing to say, right, but sometimes cliches are true. You know that it is the journey, not the destination. And if you're kind of seeking something, whatever that might be, you know, the sort of top of the mountain, and it's a very painful, painful journey to the summit, then you kind of have to ask yourself, what's it for? Because a lot of the times when you get to the top of the mountain, it doesn't actually feel quite as good as you thought it might on the way up there. Right. So you ought to at least be enjoying the ride. And often what happens when people are pursuing a goal is that they obviously become goal-directed, and that's, you know, it's important to have goals, but not when that crowds out and is at the exclusion of other things that might make you happy along the way. So, you know, if, for example, you're working very, very long hours, some of those hours are hours that you can't spend doing other things that would make you happy, like hanging out with people that you enjoy being with. And so the price that's paid in that quest for success often becomes disproportionate to the rewards that you reap afterwards.
Right. So why should someone buy your book?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's a good, I think, I mean, the first two parts, we haven't discussed the responsibility section, but the it's aimed at people who want to reflect a little bit on their own lives. And who actually might either be driven by some of these narratives and want confirmation that that's actually good for them. Because, of course, I'm not saying that these narratives are universally bad. That would be a silly story of my own to make. But people who kind of want to reflect and appraise and, just kind of be a little more thoughtful about their own desires and motivations and just kind of what it's all about. But particularly also, I think, for people who maybe making decisions on behalf of other people, like parents, practitioners, policymakers, who are affecting the lives of other people in ways that, maybe expecting them to act according to some of these stories, almost unquestioningly, because we kind of buy into these narratives because that's what society expects of us. And so it's aimed at individuals and people who are making decisions on behalf of others. And ultimately, anybody who sort of would like to, understand why they might be judgmental, of other people's lives when those other people's lives are not really affecting theirs very much. I've always been fascinated. This probably is a key motivation for the book, is I've always been fascinated by why people care so much about what other people do when what they're doing doesn't affect them.
Right. You do you.
Sorry?
You do you, and I'll do me.
Yeah, you do you, and I'll do me. It's interesting that when I just ask some really sort of basic questions at the start of each chapter to motivate them a bit, and I ask people about whether they would essentially rather be happy or live according to the narrative. I sort of trade them off against one another.
That was tough, going through the questions.
Yeah, and people are much more willing for other people to live a life of happiness than they are for themselves. Mm. And I think that's interesting, and there could be a number of different reasons for that. But I think most likely is the fact that, I feel so constrained by some of these stories that I can't break free of them. Whereas when I'm giving advice to a friend or somebody, I can kind of see them in a more detached way, and actually would like them to be happy rather than to follow the narrative when those two things are traded off against one another.
I'm going to read from the back of your book again. By freeing ourselves from the myth of the perfect life, we might each find a life worth living. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. I've been speaking to Paul Dolan, talking about his latest book, Happy Ever After, Escaping the Myth of the Perfect Life. You've been listening to Race a Game, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.